Before we get to today's show, I want to mention that this episode is brought to you by our partners at EduTech. EduTech is Australia's largest educational festival and returns to Melbourne on the 24th and 25th of August. With over 450 inspiring speakers, captivating keynotes, engaging workshops, enlightening panels, immersive breakout sessions, and 400 market leaders on the expo floor, this is an experience you won't want to miss. And yes, Ed Leaders will be there, so you can come by and say g'day to us too. Register now with code EDLEADERS30 for an extra 30% off your ticket. Visit edutech.net.au for more details. So on that note, welcome to Ed Leaders, the podcast covering all the interesting ideas about leadership, strategy, culture, and the business of K-12 education. I'm your host, Luke Callan. Joining me each week in the chair is my co-host and colleague, Matthew Irving. Before we get started, if you haven't already, you should sign up to the weekly email sent out every few weeks by the team at Ed Leaders. Matt, what should someone expect in the email if they sign up?
Well, I knew you were going to ask, Luke, so thank you for asking. Look, you know what? One of the things I really like about the newsletter is the movers and shakers part of the newsletter, because secretly everyone wants to know where people are going, what jobs they've got, and what jobs are coming up. So just a bit of a plug there. If you want to know what's happening in terms of movement in Australia around leadership, you've got to look at the newsletter.
Very good, Matt. I'm going to step up from the last few. I'm going to give you 9 out of 10 this week. Well played. You can sign up for the newsletter at edleaders.com.au. Now on to today's guest, Saku Tuominen.
Hello. Great to be here. Yeah. That was perfect.
Yeah, how'd I go with that? Did you give me a... Oh, perfect. I like that. Well played, Luke. Saku, entrepreneur, innovator, creative director, executive producer, restaurateur, author, keynote speaker, olive oil producer, and right-wing ice hockey player. But in the edgy world, he is co-founder and chair of 100ED. Is that how you say it, 100ED? How do you say it?
I think that you can say it 100.
100. Just say 100.
I think it's not that complicated.
No, but with a big E in the D, it kind of looks complicated. Anyway, 100. It helps schools and education change by seeking and sharing impactful and scalable innovations in K-12 education. So without further ado, let's get to it. Saku, welcome to the show.
Thanks for the invitation. Great to be here.
Now, I looked through your bio and I can certainly say that you have been a busy man. I like to think that I can get a lot done in a day, but I think you certainly outstrip me for the amount of things that you've done in your lifetime. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about your professional journey and especially what led you to start a business in education.
Okay, so I've been having my own company since late 1980s, have been working on media, have been leading creative teams in 20 countries. We founded a company which was all about redesigning office work. I have written 16 books about creativity, human mind, happiness, school. I have been teaching creativity in the University of Helsinki and so forth. And at the moment also, I'm a minority shareholder in 3 high-end restaurants. But I'd say maybe 10 years ago, my father was a teacher and my big passion. I would say that I'm an idealist by definition, and I love to be making a dent in the universe, making kind of like doing something meaningful with my life. And I think that making TV shows is not the highest possible way to improve world. So I kind of like thought is that what would be truly meaningful, and kind of like education has been always close to my heart, and I think that if you want to improve world, I think that there's no better place to start than a classroom. So 10 years ago, we decided to set up an education nonprofit called 100, where the basic idea was that we try to identify impactful and scalable education innovations and help them spread. And that has been my passion for the past 10 years, trying to understand. And maybe if I kind of like go to the kind of like the basic thinking behind the initiative was that there was so much complaining about education. Education is broken, it's industrial, things don't work, and so forth. And part of that is obviously true, because the world is changing so fast is that it's relatively complicated sort of like to be able to understand what kind of education would provide kids a perfect perfect skill set for the life in 2030s and so forth. But at the same time, there's so many beautiful things happening in classrooms as well. And I think that they are not getting the spotlight or the visibility they deserve. So we thought that instead of complaining about how bad things are, we said is that, okay, what if we concentrate on the sweet, on the kind of like the bright spot, on the beautiful things? And that's been really inspiring. So our approach is not to complain all the time, but says that, yeah, that's not completely true because this and this and this is happening. And it's been really inspiring.
So Saku, you talk about being an idealist. Where does that come from? Has it always existed?
Actually, I'm writing a book about kind of like trying to understand who am I, meaning why do I think like I think? Where do things originate from and so on? So I don't know, but I've been kind of like optimist and I've been curious. I've been excited about life. It's a bit of a cliche, but talking about growth mindset, meaning is that think obstacles as learning experiences, doing things and so forth. That's been the DNA of my life. And you said is that how come I've been achieving so many things and so on. I'd say that you don't mind mistakes. You accept that many things don't work. You learn from the things you do and don't concentrate on the end result. Concentrate on the day-to-day work. Try to treat people well. Try to accept that there's so few things that you really know and so on. And the essence of life is not only lifelong learning, but lifelong doing. And I think that in that mix, having some kind of healthy idealism is actually relatively important. And when I'm saying that I'm an idealist, for me, it means that I don't think that life is perfect. I think that we are having massive problems, whether we are talking about globalization or climate or what say you. But at the same time, I think that we have so much power and potential in our own hands. If we, instead of complaining, if we concentrate on solutions, if we are trying to help each other, if we are open for solutions and so on. Climate being a prime example. I actually wrote the book about climate change as well. And I kind of like wanted to understand how come a person like myself who's been trying to improve himself, how come I haven't been paying enough attention to the climate? And 3 years ago, I sort of like started to analyze why are we not making the change needed? What are the main obstacles? How should you teach? How should you make people excited? And that's kind of like part of the idealism as such, meaning that if we think that all the hope is gone, I think that all the hope is gone. If we think that it's going to be complicated, but we can come together and we can find the solutions, then we might have hope. And for me, idealism is trusting people, trusting each and everyone, trusting the growth, trusting the learning process.
In the first part of that answer, you kind of talked really about the journey and kind of enjoying a journey and embracing a journey rather than necessarily focusing on the outcome. And so I'm kind of curious as to the journey over the last 10 years, in going, you obviously had this idea and, you know, have this idealist kind of background. But what's that journey been like as you moved into an area that you weren't necessarily familiar with, you know, in terms of your background?
Let's say that the starting point was an interesting insight that I've been working in many areas, have been excited about education, but have been doing my life's work mostly outside of the education. And I've been always wondering is that how come education is so closed? Meaning is that sometimes I've joked and said is that education is a bit like Las Vegas, meaning is that whatever happens in Las Vegas stays in Las Vegas. And exactly. And kind of like saying is that whatever happens in classroom stays in classroom. So I'd say that Finland is a silo, Germany is a silo, all the cities in Germany are silos, all the schools. And I cannot, if I'm thinking about art, composing, science, AI, business, all the countries are learning from each other. They learn kind of like what works, they are changing information and so on. Whereas in education, there's relatively small amount of learning from each other. And I found that kind of like really intriguing. Then coming from Finland, which many people still think that is one of the leading countries in education, there was some kind of anniversary in Finland, and one organization contacted us and thought that what could we do to promote the Finnish education globally? And we thought that, okay, let's identify 100 impactful innovations happening in Finnish classrooms that could help every country in the world and spread them for free. So this is the way we are teaching this and this and this. And we thought that actually this is an inspiring, interesting idea and so forth. But then something interesting happened, because I think that it's not without truth to say that Finnish education system is on average quite okay. But does it mean that we have the best education innovations in the world? I would say that that's probably not the case. Because quite often when everything is working quite okay, the need for radical innovations is not there. So my insight relatively early on the journey was that in Finland, the essence of Finnish education brilliance is that every school is relatively okay. So I would say that in Finland, we have the best worst schools in the world. So we might not have the 5-star schools, but we are definitely not having 1-star schools. So I'd say that we have the best average in the world. And I think that it's partly also related to the society. But if I'm analyzing, for example, education innovations in India, in Africa, in sometimes in the US and so on, I think many of those are actually more ambitious, more impactful as such. So I'm kind of like interested on combination on how could we cooperate. So I would be kind of like quite excited on the notion is that we are identifying something impactful in Africa, and we could be taking that idea and somehow try to use that kind of thinking in the Finnish context rather than other way around. Quite often we think is that, okay, we could be exporting the Finnish system to Mexico City or to Kuala Lumpur. But the problem is that I'm not certain if you would take the Finnish education ecosystem and you would transfer that one to Nigeria, I don't think that that would work, because it's all about the quality of the teachers, whereas in sub-Saharan Africa, you don't have the teachers and so on. So I'm kind of like thinking is that in Finland, in country as Finland, we should be a lot more curious and open towards other countries and trying to learn from them as well. And I think that that kind of dialogue doesn't happen. So that was sort of like the first thing when we started, is that I think that I still haven't found a country in which something exciting, interesting is not happening. I think that there's beautiful things happening in each and every country. But then maybe the other thing that has been really meaningful for me has been the notion of, or the role of implementation in making the change happen. Whenever you go to practically any education event, there's a lot of discussion about why schools should change. It's industrial, outdated, not enough social emotional skills and so on and so on. Exactly the same kind of discussion in every event. And then you are talking about what should we do? 6 E's, curiosity, cooperation, exactly the same kind of solution. But the only discussion that is lacking is how. How do you make the change happen fast enough in scale so that no one is left behind? And that's complicated, because you have to have patience, you have to have vision, you have to have resources, and so on. So you cannot say to teachers is that, okay, now you have to radically change the way you teach, but you don't have any resources and we are not going to be educating you. And then I can easily understand is that in many of the countries, that's the main friction at the moment, meaning is that teachers feel that they are left alone, they are not kind of like back, they are not understood, they feel that they are not heard and so on. So I think that that's kind of like, you have to have the patience to make the change happen, and you have to have the resources. And it's complicated, also partly because it's a political process in many countries. There's elections and so on. So trying to make it fast, trying to make it in a way that your voters like it, not having enough resources, being hectic, going right for 2 years and then going left for following 2 years and so on. It's easy to see why people are getting burned out.
I'm really interested in the idea of, you know, looking at the Finnish system, and, you know, of course it's revered around the world. But I wonder what it's been like for you to, I guess, let people know that it's not as great as they think it is, that teachers and leaders and system leaders in Finland perhaps need to reflect and go, well, maybe it's not as great as we first thought. So how do you go about starting that conversation?
Actually, great question. My answer is totally unlike what you were hoping for, because the discussion at the moment in Finland is that how disastrous it is. So people are extremely unhappy with the system. For example, yesterday in the biggest newspaper in Finland, it was like 6 pages about the crisis in Finnish education, meaning is that everything is lost, everything is bad, everything is problematic, and so on. And my take on that one is that it's not that bad. You know, we are having so many things which are relatively okay. We still have great teachers. Even if there's kind of like the gap between the best schools and the worst schools is growing, still we are not having massive learning gap. There's relatively small amount of school shopping, meaning is that you are taking your kids to the best school and so on. So I would say that there's many things in Finland which are fairly okay. But what I'm saying is that, like mentioned, is that we are not ambitious enough, we are not open-minded enough, we are not curious enough and so on, but it's not all that bad and so on. So looking from inside out, I'd say that in Finland we are complaining a bit too much. We are not seeing the value in things and so on. So it's a really odd thing following the education debate in Finland about Finland and in, for example, Australia or any other country about Finland. They are like two totally different kind of discussions. So I'd say that my take in here is that it's not great, it's not awful. It has its own challenges at the moment. But maybe it's kind of like, one of my favorite books about innovation is a book called Innovation Paradox. And what is innovation paradox in other industries? The basic idea is that how do you become successful by taking risks? What happens when you are successful? You start avoiding risks because you want to stay successful. A classic example was Nokia. They took massive risks, became the world leader in mobile phones. Then they started to kind of like do everything they can in order to not to lose the position. And then everything kind of like vanished in 2-3 years. And I'd say that in Finnish education, it's not totally unlike. Meaning is that in 1970s, 80s, we were taking huge amount of risks. And out of those, almost it was almost kind of like by surprise for many. Because the PISA and everything, something great was born, meaning is that we had an extremely equal education system, great teachers, we were able to combine excellence and equity and so on and so on. So many great things came out of those. But then once you are the leader in the PISA, it's a complicated position to stay improving because many people are opposing that one and saying is that, why should we change anything because we are already the best one? And that's never great because we live in a world which is changing extremely fast, whether you are thinking about the climate, the way the work life is developing, AI, GPT, mental challenges and so forth. So I think that we don't have the privilege on not changing anything because the world outside is changing. And if you're kind of like successful, it's complicated to change. If everything is messed up, if everything is kind of like not working, it's a lot easier. And that's why I've been guessing that most likely the biggest innovations in education will actually come from continents like Africa, because they don't have anything to lose. If you kind of like have 4 billion people without any teachers, it's not a massive risk to try something new, because kind of like it's such an urgent and complicated situation and so on. So that's why I'm actually quite excited to follow innovations in Africa and so on. I think that a lot of the thinking behind the future of education will come from the most unfortunate areas.
What I think's interesting about what you've just described is that I wonder if there's any country that has a narrative within its own country that education is doing really well. You know, like what you've just described as, you know, like the challenges in the Finnish system, we would probably have those same newspaper articles year on year about the Australian system. And I'm sure the Americans, English, other, you know, countries have a very similar kind of narrative that we tend to pick out what we're not doing well at. And I think that's kind of interesting. And I'd also add, I wonder, you know, your point around can we make change fast enough? And I often think that sometimes what we see at conferences and the conversations that come as evidence-based, or that, you know, well-respected academics will say this is what we should be doing more of in education. Sometimes the challenges with that for educators is that those people who are in higher education or professors and whatnot don't spend a lot of time in classrooms or in schools and really understand how hard, or the challenges, or the what makes these things very difficult to actually implement on the ground, you know, whether that's in one school, in an independent school, or a systemic system where there's a couple of hundred schools. And I think that's a real challenge. And I wonder what you've seen when you've been trying to assist, you know, different people in education with innovation and change, what you've seen when it comes to that.
As mentioned, is that I don't pretend to be the world's leading expert on education, because my life is outside of that one. But kind of like, it might have pros as well, because I've been following life, how to teach, mindset, actually 21st century skills, like social emotional skills and so on, outside of school. And then I have been following education in tens of countries as well. So I'd say that my kind of like take on education is slightly different than of many, but I'd say that not without value. But I'm not trying to pretend to be the leading expert. Pasi Salberg can take that position. He's a good friend of mine, but kind of like
very well known. You cannot call,
exactly. Yep.
He's last year in Perth.
He's a good friend, and I have extremely high respect of that one. But I'd say that education is complicated because you have gatekeepers in every level, meaning is that you have principals, you have local gatekeepers, country-level gatekeepers, and so on and so on. And I think that whenever you mention education, you always get the image of what education is. And education is a building. School is a building. And in building, you have classrooms, and you have curriculum, and you have teachers, and you have classes, and so on. And an interesting question for me is that, does it have to be the case? Could it be something totally different? Does education have to be national? Could we have K-12 education, which is global? And for me, some interesting kind of like initiatives have been, there was a discussion in India where it used to be traditionally so that the most unfortunate were dropping out of the school. And now there's been a small proportion of people which are sort of like the best ones in the school are dropping out of the system, because they think that I can get much more value if I'm outside of the school, studying in platforms and so on and so on. And I think that that's kind of like interesting. I wouldn't be surprised if a big percentage of K-12 education in 2050 is actually global. Many people go like, I don't want to stick to Australian or Finnish system. I want to kind of like be in a global system because we live in a global world. I'm not saying is that that happens, but I'm saying is that if that happens, what would it mean to the education. I think that it's kind of like something that we should take into the account. I would be actually more surprised if that wouldn't happen rather than if it would happen.
So, Saka, let's talk a little bit about 100 and the work that you do in finding, you know, those innovation partners and projects that are scalable and having impact. Talk to us about the mission and purpose of 100 and I guess the business model and how you partner with innovation projects.
Okay, so first of all is that define business model, because we are a non-profit. So there is no business model as such. We are getting funding from organizations, foundations, some companies and so on, but everything is transparent and as mentioned, non-profit. And what we do is that we try to identify innovations that are impactful and scalable. Okay, I know that whenever I'm discussing about education, I have to analyze what is the audience. So for teachers, I extremely seldom mention the word innovation because most of the teachers hate it. and if I'm, for example, saying to teachers is that we are identifying innovations, I hate innovations. And then I'm asking, is that great? Understand, what is it that you want to see? I want to see simple things that work and that can work in other classrooms as well. I said, yeah, that's innovation. So I kind of like it. It can be, we can call whatever name, but what we are kind of like thinking is that if we are trying to find a new ways to enhance social emotional learning or fight bullying or teach history or encourage people to kind of like read or whatever that is, there's a lot of valuable things happening all over the world. So what we are trying to do is that first of all, we try to identify is that is this impactful? Meaning, does this work? And that's why whenever we are identifying or selecting an innovation, it has to have some sort of track record and it has to have evidence of working. It doesn't mean that it works in every country of the world. It means that it has been working in this country. Then the other question is that the word of scalability, what we mean by that is that does it have potential to work in other places other than this? Not only other cities, but other countries, even other continents. And we don't think that everything has to work in every place of the world, but we are trying to identify things that have potential to spread outside of that country. So something that is impactful and scalable. And those are sort of like the key things. Then many people are asking from us is that, but how do I know what works in Australia? And my answer is that I don't. I haven't got the faintest idea, but that's not what we do. We are, for example, identifying that, okay, these are the ways to teach history or coding or whatever. And then we are presenting the results and we are connecting people with the innovators and saying that if you are excited about teaching AI, these are great examples of that one and so forth. So we identify. And then it's on the receiving end is the decision whether A, I love this, I want to implement this. B, I'm excited, I want to learn more. C, something interesting, but I think that we should be making our own version. Or D, I hate it, I don't want to do anything like that. And all of these are fine. I think that the key point for us is that if you are trying to take education into one direction, it's valuable to see examples of what other countries are doing. And that's kind of like the essence. So not forcing anything, only trying to inspire. And that's kind of like the essence that we are doing.
And when you think about those projects, once they're selected, what happens next for them? You know, you've talked about the platform that you have, you know, via the website. How do you, you know, go about the distribution of, you know, the 100?
So what we are doing is that we've selected, I'd say, around 500 scalable innovations, and we have been doing spotlights, like we identify a theme, and then we select innovations within that theme. We could be doing an innovation within AI or in spotlight on climate change and so on. We are doing one in gamification, meaning what are a great and impactful ways to use gamification as part of the learning. So it can be kind of like anything in that sense. But when we select those, first of all, is that we study. We are having our ambassadors in over 100 countries. We are doing research. We try to identify hundreds of possible innovations. Then we select short list of maybe 250. We are interviewing the innovators, trying to find out the true impact of those. Then out of those, we make short list of 150 to 200. Then we are taking them to our expert or advisory board, which is consisting of roughly around 200 people coming from all continents, principals, university people, teachers, and so on. And they identify that, okay, like this, don't like this, impactful, scalable. And out of those, we create a collection of 100 innovations. We package those so that, for example, one thing which sounds mundane, but it's not at all, is kind of like Google, the search engine optimization. So for example, when you are looking for fighting bullying and so forth, you kind of like quite easily end up on our page. And then extremely clearly written is that this is the problem this innovation is solving. This is the basic idea. These are the examples how to use it. These are the countries in which they are. And this is the feedback from the experts. And this is the contact person. So that's kind of like valuable. And we have already hundreds of thousands of people visiting the website annually. Then there's quite often education events, education media contacting us and saying that, okay, we are doing article or we want to be showcasing innovators in that area. We are more than happy to connect those. The innovators can be approaching us and say that I want to be spreading to India. Do you have ambassadors, contact people in India? We are more than happy to connect those. And so on and so on. So what is our role in here is that we don't implement anything. What we do is that we identify innovations and we create connections. But the implementation is happening kind of like in schools, with the governments, with the cities and so on. So we are only like almost like a think tank meets middleman.
And do you ever get stories of impact once an innovation's been implemented? Is there a feedback loop that comes back to you?
Yes, there is. And we are always asking for more feedback. But I'd say that there's tens of stories where the innovator says that they were able to get funding because of being selected. They were trying to find new kind of schools, governments that were excited. New connections and so on. And they are happening all the time. And we also have a tool at the moment called 100 TaylorMade, where the basic idea is that any country or city can be approaching us and says that we have this kind of problem. We want to be, let's say, teaching. We want to be inspired. We want to be enhancing the creative skills in our schools. What we do is that we identify together with the city some innovations which are local, then we try to identify some innovations which are global. Then together with the local teachers and so on, they identify maybe the three ones that they could be trying in their schools. Then based on that know-how, they will be implementing some of those and then they will continue. And for example, now with the city of Helsinki, we are testing kind of like new ways to. They are, for example, using people who are having problems with reading and kind of like being really closed, having problems with the language and so on. They are using one innovation coming from India called Slam Out Loud, where they are using rapping and other kind of performance arts in order to kind of like to build the mindset and sort of like the skill set of expressing themselves through that one. And really interesting. It's also meaningful for Finnish teachers saying is that, okay, exciting to try things which are working in India and so on. It's not without problems, but it's inspiring. And I think that even in the cases when they don't work, it will lead into something valuable.
Are you doing anything to also support schools more, like, or people that are wanting to do more of this? I guess it kind of goes back to that kind of question or that notion that you put forward earlier around, you know, what you hear a lot of is here's the innovations, but how do you actually make it happen? And I'm wondering, where's the gap there for that?
It's a really good question. And to be honest, is that first of all, is that we are present in all continents and we have a team of 15, 20 people working on this daily. We have people who are helping us in many countries and so on, but we are a small organization. And that's why our main priority, unfortunately, is not helping a specific school, because it becomes, it's a really painful process, as we all know, to implement something and so on, because it takes time, it takes dialogue and so on. What we are trying to do is that we try to do it at scale, meaning is that maybe, for example, with the city or with a chain of schools or with the country and so on, we sort of like try to explain is that this is what is essential in implementing education innovations. These are the do's, these are the don'ts. At the moment, we are creating a MOOC for teachers and also leaders in education, helping them to understand what is the essence of education innovation or scaling innovations in a meaningful way. Because there's so many people who are doing the mistakes. They think that they scale automatically. There's no one leading the implementation. There's not enough resources and so on. So what we are trying to do is that we try to explain is that, okay, this is the way to implement education innovations in a way that no one is left behind, the teachers get it, the impact is not vanishing in air and so on. And it's a complicated one. It's not a simple. We are the first one to say is that implementing education innovations, maintaining excellence and equity is a really complicated thing. But does it mean that it should not be tried? No, definitely not. But humble. I mean, 10 years in this one teaches a lot of being really humble, meaning is that this kind of like the thinking is quite often a bit superficial. There's no buy-in from the teachers, not enough resources, no one is leading the process and so on. I'd say that the main mistakes in here are almost the same in all of the countries.
If you love what we do here at EdLeaders, then please support us by supporting our sponsors. And as you heard at the top of the show, today's sponsor is EduTech. EduTech is one giant festival for all of education, and this year is happening on the 24th and 25th of August at the Melbourne Convention Exhibition Centre. Not only will you hear from an amazing lineup of speakers, including today's guest, you'll also be able to meet us there. Yes, that's right. EdLeaders is coming to Melbourne, and you'll be able to stop by and say g'day in the exhibition hall, featuring over 450 exhibitors, where you can see some of the latest and greatest from the world of technology and innovation. Aside from seeing us there, you can learn from some of the best educators around the globe with learning streams for school leaders, teachers, ICT managers, and digital technology, just to name a few. There are also boundless opportunities to hang out, network, make new connections, and exchange ideas. If there is one conference this year to level up your leadership game, this is it. Register now with code EDLEADERS30, that's EDLEADERS30, for 30% off your ticket. Visit edutech.net.au for details. And make sure you support us by stopping by and saying hello. Now let's get back to today's show.
Sako, you're not supposed to have any favourite children, but surely there's some innovations out there that absolutely get you excited. And, you know, your idealist brain switches on and you're ready to, you know, impact sort of, you know, the global education environment. Is there, you know, one or two that you just go, look, there's something here, you know, that's worth sharing today?
My policy has been always is that I don't want to mention any of those for the obvious reasons. Having said that, maybe I'll kind of like give short examples. One could be a innovation called Room to Read, which is a program which is trying to enhance the habit of reading in low-income environments, especially among girls. And the things they do are mind-blowing. It's kind of like they are quite often operating with the governments. They have been helping tens of millions of kids. They are in 20-plus countries and so on. And when you sort of like go through is that what they are doing, how they are doing it, how do they get funding, what are the results and so on, throughout it's mind-blowing. So when people say that education innovations, they don't spread, you go like, that's not the case. Many of them don't, but many of them do as well. So Room to Read is a really ambitious, great example of a well-funded, high-impact, ambitious nonprofit education innovation that is making massive change happening each and every day. But then if we kind of like take the other end of the spectrum, one innovation which I really like is a coming from India called Project Fuel, where the basic idea is how to teach growth mindset or social emotional skills. The basic idea of that one is that they are collecting life lessons of people that quite often are not heard. So it can be, for example, someone driving the bus and taking kids to school, or someone cooking in the school cafeteria, or janitor, or whatever. And they are telling is that, okay, what has been my life lesson? Which means that you can see is that each and every one of us are having a life lesson. And then they are putting kids to collect life lessons. And it's extremely simple to do. It's scalable. There's no budget needed. And it's extremely powerful and meaningful. And I cannot see that there's, I think that if done well, it will work in every school of the world, no matter what the budget is, because it's all about trying to kind of like see the beauty and the empowerment in each and every one of us, not only with the ones that are getting the most visibility and so on. So I'd say that the 100 innovations, for example, in a global collection, I would say that even if you don't agree with all of those, I'd say that each and everyone are having a lesson for everyone working in education. There's so many beautiful things there.
One of the things that I would be envious of in your role would be this notion that you get to see at a macro level the challenges that are going on in different countries and the complexities of different environments, you know, whether it be in Europe or Africa or wherever it happens to be, or, you know, in Australia. I'm wondering if you have come across, you know, in the way that you've seen innovations roll out or those that you've helped, some of the preconditions in some of those countries or cities or systems where that need to be there for innovations to be successful?
Well, I would say that the main notion is that it's a big world. And we have extremely limited understanding of the challenges happening in other countries. And for example, in Finland, for example, we, not everyone, but we tend to say is that we have to take the Finnish education know-how to Africa and we have to help them to improve their education ecosystem. And then I'm asking is that, great, what is your solution? And then they say, for example, is that we have to help them to understand is that it all starts with the teachers. They have to have great teachers. And then when you're discussing with African experts, they say is that, I don't disagree. There's a need for 30 million teachers within the following 10 years. We don't know where to find them. We don't have money to educate them. What are we doing for the following 10 to 20 years? And then you go like, okay, let's start thinking again. So sort of like having the humbleness and so on, that should be the key thing, is that you try to understand is that, okay, what are the challenges? What are the budgets? And so on. For example, discussing about using digital platforms, they don't have Wi-Fi, they might not have electricity, and so on. So it's so kind of like complicated. And I think that we should always start with the humbleness of trying to understand what are the challenges in this specific country, rather than thinking is that everything that we've done in our country will work in other countries. That's not the case.
Saku, as I'm thinking through, you know, how you've constructed the organization, you know, it's really interesting to me that you've got quite a unique ecosystem of developing networks across the world. So from your ambassadors to your expert advisory, you know, group, to also the people that work in your organization of the 15 to 20, how have you gone about constructing, you know, that ecosystem and finding the right people?
Well, I'd say that maybe I'll mention one thing which we are in the middle of setting up, I'd say already this year. We have the funding in place. We are setting up 100, as you can see, the brand is not there yet because it's a bit complicated name. But what we are setting up is Education Innovation Implementation Center, which means that we are setting up in Switzerland a organization which is studying the complexity of implementing education innovations at scale. So the basic idea would be is that, for example, if country A took an innovation from country B and then they were able to scale that one in a meaningful and successful way to 100 plus cities, for example, what did they do? How did they build the process? What were the mistakes they made? And so on, because there's so many innovations which are great, but the spreading of the innovation doesn't work. It's done superficially and so on. And then there's examples of the opposite. So kind of like trying to understand, trying to gain the know-how of a great, meaningful education innovation. That's kind of like where we are at the moment. I think that we are among the best ones on identifying what is out there and what works. But we are not nearly good enough in sort of like the hardcore, the kind of like the really hands-on scaling on do's and don'ts. And then going back to the finding people and so on, I think that, as mentioned, is that I have a lot of my background outside of the education. Maybe that's one of the reasons why we want to be extremely precise, is that most of the people working for us have to have know-how from teaching or studying in university, having kind of like education background and so on. We don't want to come as outsiders and have almost like banal, superficial solutions to really complex problems. We want to say is that, okay, we don't know, it's complicated, it takes time, we don't have answers and so on. We are learning ourselves and so on. So I'd say that each and every person, they have to have an educator's mindset. They have to have the patience. They have to have the genuine curiosity and so on. We don't want to be superficial and we don't want to be giving simple, as mentioned, simple solutions to complex problems. We want to kind of like, we want to be in this with the long term. But the good thing with us is that we've been going through so many due diligence processes of big organizations like World Bank or Lego Foundation or OECD and so on. They go like, okay, show us how you do what you do. And then we are saying is that, okay, this is the process. This is how we do it. These are the weaknesses and so on. And we try to be as transparent as possible. And when big foundations one after another go like, this is actually quite impressive. We like what you do. You have been thinking many things and so on. It gives you confidence that it's not perfect, but it's not all wrong either. And so on. So I would say that how do we find people? Genuine curiosity, background in education, openness, humbleness, and so on. So that's kind of like the team we are trying to build at the moment.
As an extension of that question, finding the support to make it happen, finding, you know, the donors to help support you, open the doors to help you support you doing what you do. As an extension of that, how do you find that and make that happen?
I'd say that you cannot force it. I cannot go to Melbourne or Sydney and saying that this is what you should do. I think that the kind of like the drive to change, willingness to change, willingness to try has to start from the place itself. So every time when something has been successful, it starts with the city, for example. They go like, we want to be improving, we are open, we want to try new things and so on. So I'd say that there should be demand rather than push. So I think that whenever we are trying to force something, that doesn't really happen, which means that kind of like the person who wants to or organization or city or country who wants to cooperate with us, they should have the funding, they should have the resources, they should have the commitment, they should have the long-term strategy, and then it's meaningful. If we kind of like come outside in and saying that, okay, we have small amount of funding, let us change the education in New Zealand, it won't work. It will be a total disaster. We are doing more harm than the other way around.
So I'm interested, you know, here at Ed Leaders, we talk about leadership sort of identity, if you like. I'm really curious, what kind of leader are you day to day and what do people say about you?
Normally, people who answer this question have only got one business to lead or one school to lead. You've kind of got multiple businesses that you're leading.
I'd say that in theory, I'm good. In practice, I'm extremely far from good. I know how I should lead people, but it's not simple. What I've been kind of like also learning is that one of my big passions is creativity and implementation. So I want to have big ideas. I want to think. I want to kind of like go for the bold implementation and so on. And sometimes kind of like combining that one with genuine listening, dialogue, being open and so on. It's a really delicate balance. So I would say that as understanding what great leadership is, I would give myself high remarks in day-to-day work, actually relatively low. So I'm kind of like, the good thing is that I've been doing X amount of kind of like self-reflection, even mindfulness and so on. So I quite early on understand when I'm not doing a good job. So that's kind of like, that's been a big improvement, saying is that I'm not listening enough. There's not enough dialogue and so on and so on. So I kind of like understand that one, but it's still a long way to the kind of like skillful implementation or execution of that one. But it's a learning process. I think that I will never ever be a great one, but I try to be honest, meaning is that I try to admit when I'm not happy with the things, how things are. And a good example is that after this podcast, I'm having a 90-minute discussion with one of our employees, and not for 100, but for another company. And she was asking is that what is the agenda for the meeting? And I replied with two words, meaning your happiness. And the key of that one is that I can kind of like identify is that for some reason, she's not flourishing. She's not happy kind of like regarding where she is. There's some kind of locks and so on. So the point in here is that I try to admit is that I see that this is not working and so on. And I kind of like want to listen. So that's sort of like it goes also from not knowing yourself, but being open and being genuine and being transparent and being willing to listen and so on. But these are obvious things, as mentioned, easy in theory, complicated in practice.
And whether it's your own leadership that you've just been describing there, or whether it's, you know, in terms of education or, you know, the other businesses that you're involved with, is there a person or people that you're inspired by yourself?
Oh, there's dozens of them, but if I would kind of like, if I would have to mention one group of people that inspire me practically always, that is never visible in almost any of the education events, for example, is kids. So I'd say that out of the people in education events, 99% are adults. And I would be giving like 10 times more visibility for kids, meaning is that how do they see education? What are the key things? What do they think about not reading books and so on and so on? So that would be one thing. Then another one is that I was, for example, in one education event where there were two teachers discussing about what is the role of a great teacher. And then the first one said something like this: the role of a teacher is to inspire kids. And I was thinking, is that great? Yeah, I can kind of like see myself agreeing with that one. And then the second one said is that no, the key role is to be inspired by kids. And I thought that that's actually quite meaningful. Meaning is that you are so open that you let yourself to be inspired by kids each and every day. And that kind of thinking is extremely meaningful for me. So I would say that teachers who have been in the classroom for 30 years and are still full of passion and drive, those are so much more exciting than big names telling what is wrong in education. Having said that, I had the privilege to work with late Sir Ken Robinson quite a lot, and I had a huge amount of discussions with him and so on. And his thinking about the direction of education was inspiring as well. So I would say that few big names like Pasi, like Ken Robinson, then teachers who have been working for a long time and are still inspired, and then kids. That would be kind of like my starting point.
So we're gearing up for EduTech in August. You're coming to Australia. It's your first visit. What can the audience expect to hear from you?
Well, I would.
Are you still working it out?
I'm still working it out, and most likely I will be working it out until the last minute. But my main point would be is that I've been working with education innovations for the past 10 years. I've been seeing the problems, the challenges, the beauty of great solutions and so on in all continents. So maybe it's sort of like doing a combination of key findings on how to make the change happen and also how not to make the change happen, but also giving X amount of really practical examples. And so meaning is that, okay, this was the problem, this was the solution, this is how it worked and so on. And try to identify solutions which some of them can be really complicated, but some of them can be brilliantly simple as well. So I'd say that inspiring, insightful, hopefully, but also practical. So those could be kind of like the three things.
Well, I think people should definitely get along to check out whatever you're presenting. That brings an end to our show of the main part of the question, Saku. But we are now at my favorite part of the show, which is 16, 60 seconds. It is Matt's least favorite part of the show, but that's because he doesn't get to say anything. So with that, the rules are pretty simple. It's one word or idea for each question. And probably I would say that 99% of people don't follow that rule. So you do what you want.
Okay.
One educational narrative that's been underrated or overrated in the past decade.
School is in crisis because it has problems, but it has beautiful things happening as well.
The most interesting professional experience you've ever been part of.
Every mistake has been valuable.
If you could change one rule or one thing in education, what would it be?
Concentrate on positives. Enough complain, not too much complaining, not enough positive.
One book worth reading?
At the moment, I'd say The Creative Act by Rick Rubin. Beautiful book about creativity. Stunningly inspiring.
By the look of it, you and Matt have quite considerable collections, both of you. Look at you. you're making my three books down here a little bit to shame. The most interesting person you've ever met at a conference?
Kids. I cannot mention one, but I would say that every time I encounter kids, I try to stop and discuss about them, about the future of education, what makes you exciting, what is challenging and so on, trying to be open and so on. I would say that those discussions are always the best ones.
And one person we should interview on the podcast?
Kids.
I like that you kept with your theme. I'm going to give you a 7 out of 10 for your answers there. Well played.
That's pretty good. That's pretty good.
Well, that brings an end to the show for today. I hope you've enjoyed our little chat with Saku. Matt? Closing comments. Hit us with them. I know you've got them.
A couple of highlights for me. I love the conversation we had around the innovation paradox, you know, that we take risks as we lead to being successful, but once we are successful, we avoid risks at our peril. And I like that idea that, you know, the greatest innovations we might see in education will come from areas of great disadvantage. And I think that's there's something for us to consider there. And the last piece, just, you know, the purpose of 100 is to really be that think tank meets middleman to identify innovation, to connect people globally. And the comment, there are so many beautiful things out there. That's going to stay with me, you know, for the rest of the day. So thank you. Luke, what have you got?
I've got a couple of things that I've put asterisks next to. And I guess for me, one of them really is around that, you know, fundamentally I can see it with what you've done and how you talk about it is your desire to impact. And Matt and I think have a similar desire to have impact in education and through this podcast, I think we're trying to do it at a mostly a national level in terms of the narrative around leadership in education and the things that should be on people's radars. That is not just what an academic is telling, school teachers and leaders, but that genuine desire. And I think you, you're playing at a different level to us around your desire to impact education globally. And I think that's a, you know, a really interesting kind of challenge for, well, for me personally to think of, am I thinking broadly enough with my desire to have impact in education? And I really appreciate you sharing that with us, and also, you know, take my hat off to you for having that broad kind of global lens on your desire to have impact and meaningful impact beyond kind of your original career in film and TV. So that was one aspect. A couple of other things were around, you know, that idealistic nature. I think sometimes I play a little bit in that space, and I think we'd all do well to be a bit idealistic sometimes. And thirdly, I guess that notion of the gatekeepers in education, and thinking about how many of those that we have, you know, at various levels of education, and what we can do, you know, and what organizations like 100 is doing, and you know, what maybe we could do at Ed Leaders is to help some of those gatekeepers unlock their gates, you know, and try and make it a bit simpler for some of these innovations that, you know, that you're surfacing on a global scale to be able to be implemented. And I think that's a real, you know, interesting challenge for us to think about, and for those people that are listening to the show who are gatekeepers, for them to kind of think more broadly about how they can do that. So yes, that's the notions from me. Saku, thank you again for giving up your time to be on the podcast all the way from Helsinki and Finland. And we certainly look forward to meeting you face to face in person at EduTech later in the year. Is there any like closing comments you'd like to say? And obviously for the audience out there, if they want to connect with you personally or 100, how can they do that via the internet?
Well, first of all, is that whenever trying to make change happen in education, I think that we should always try to start with the fundamental question regarding the role of education, meaning what is the purpose of education? And I think that that's kind of like, for me, a really inspiring starting point. And for me, the purpose of education is to help every child flourish in life, no matter what happens. Then it means that we kind of like should have a vague understanding of the life in 2030s. And for example, if you take GPT or AI and so on, what does it mean to be flourishing in work life with the time of AI? And I think that that's kind of like already a really valuable discussion which we should have. It's so much wider and broader than thinking is that can we use GPT in the classroom? That's not the essential question. The essential question is that how does it affect my life 10 years from now on? And I think that we should kind of like go to the fundamentals and starting from those, think about the life in 10 or 15 or 20 years. That would be kind of like my main message for everyone. And then building on that one, 100.org, huge amount of great content that deserves to be seen. As mentioned, you don't have to like everything, but I'm definite that there's a lot of inspiring things. If you spend 60 minutes in there studying 50 innovations, it will be a valuable 60 minutes.
I couldn't agree more. Having only really come across the website since connecting with yourself, it's a treasure trove of useful things to sit down and sift through, and certainly lots of impactful programs happening around the world. I was certainly inspired by the website. So congratulations on all the things that you've done. It's certainly inspiring.
Thank you so much.
From my point of view.
Thanks, Luke. Thanks, Matt.
For the audience out there, please remember, if you haven't already, subscribe to the show, and don't forget to share the love and tell a few of your colleagues maybe that they should be listening to this episode of Ed Leaders if they are interested in innovation. As I mentioned at the top of the show, you can sign up to the Ed Leaders newsletter, where we publish a newsletter every couple of weeks, jam-packed with nuggets to level up your school leadership game. Check it out at edleaders.com.au for more details. Thanks again to the sponsors of today's show, our partners for this series, EduTech. Check out the EduTech website, get your tickets. You'll see us, you'll see Saku and many others out there. And we'll be grateful if you support them as they help us to support this, support us making this professional learning free for you. You can connect with Ed Leaders and both of us on LinkedIn, where you'll keep up to date with all the latest. Thanks again for listening, and we'll catch you next week.
Go well.